Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, a four-part series on KALW, tackling taboos around death and dying. Now that you're listening, you've already tackled the toughest part, joining the conversation. If you're a little, okay, very uncomfortable, you're not alone. Hang in there. I invite you to have a seat and stay curious. Caring for people with life-altering and life-threatening illnesses is my work and my passion. I'm a medical doctor and a scientist, and I serve on the palliative care team at UCSF, where I get to help patients talk with their families and doctors, so care that matters is the only thing delivered. My work gives me a unique vantage point. I see how devastating life and death can be in the absence of talking, but I also know how inspiring and profound life can be when we do talk. You know, the cliche, there are two certainties in life, death and taxes, is particularly pertinent this time of year. And as we're talking a lot about taxes, you might notice we don't talk so much about death. In fact, a survey conducted by the Conversation Project suggests that about 90% of people say talking about end-of-life care with their loved ones is important, yet only about 30% have actually done it. Advanced care planning conversations have become increasingly important because how we live and die has become increasingly complex. And thanks to a new Medicare ruling, healthcare providers are now being encouraged and reimbursed to sit down with all of their patients to develop an advanced care plan every year throughout the year. So one of the best ways to begin is by discovering what matters most to you. Now, I realize that for many, many people, including some members of my family whom you're about to meet, jumping into these conversations can be daunting, to put it mildly. Fortunately, many tools have been created to help make these conversations far more approachable. And you can find links to several of these, as well as earlier conversations in this series on Dying to Talk, at our webpage on kalw.org. One of my personal favorites is a game called Go Wish. Joining me tonight in studio to play Go Wish are my two eldest children, Josh and Isabel Gross. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks, Mom, for having me.
Isabel.
Hi, thanks so much for letting me be here.
You know, if I were Garrison Keillor, I would say without humility that these are your above-average urban teenagers. I will unabashedly add that they are the light of my life and have courageously agreed to join this conversation tonight. With them is my husband, Andrew Gross. He's also a physician at UCSF. Andy's a rheumatologist, which means he helps care for people with arthritis and joint disease. And for as much as I am dying to talk about these things, I think it's safe to say Andy's not. Andy, thank you so much for being here with me tonight and with our children.
I'm happy to be here.
So just to give everyone some background on this game, Go Wish, it's a simple deck of cards with single sentences printed on each one. There are about 36 in the deck. And I have asked Isabel and Josh, as well as Andy, to play this game prior to our coming to the studio tonight to save time and have us be able to jump into the conversation. But to give everyone listening in a sense of this, the way you play is to take this deck of cards and to sort them into three piles, a pile that's most important to you, saying you read a sentence and go, yeah, that matters to me, that resonates. A pile that's in the middle saying, you know, kind of, sort of, and then a pile that's, you know, I really don't care about this, doesn't mean anything to me. And then you take that deck of cards, as you'll see, and we start sharing them. We start having a conversation about what they mean. What they mean to each other individually may not be the same, even if we pick the same card, and why they mean that to us. There's a different way to play, which is actually the way I was first taught to play, what I call the reverse direction, which is when you're asked to sort the cards the way you think someone else would sort for themselves. And so when I first was taught this game, I sorted for my brother. And when I didn't get his number one card in the top 10 of sorted cards, I realized I had a lot to learn. No matter how much I thought I knew him and loved him, it's time to have a real conversation. So, Isabel and Josh, I asked you to imagine something that was actually, unfortunately for us, pretty imaginable, which was, what would it be like if, say, Dad were really sick, so sick that he actually couldn't tell us, he couldn't talk with us about what mattered to him, what kind of medical care he wanted. And say I was not here either. Maybe I've already died, or maybe I was also sick at the same time. And although legally you would not be put in this position, given that you're 15 and 16, soon enough you're going to be 18, in which case you actually could be asked to make decisions for us. So I asked you guys to sort the cards separately, imagining what matters most to Dad. And Josh, I wonder if you wouldn't mind starting sharing what you think as you imagine that pretty unimaginable situation. What's the first card that came to mind? What was the first thing that you felt was most important to Dad?
So the first thing that popped into my mind when I was reading the cards was that he loves his family. And so I chose the card that he would want his family with him when he was dying.
When he was dying or
in the hospital.
Or in the hospital, very sick, that the first thing to do is to gather family. And who do you define family for Dad? What would he say his family is?
His mom, his dad, his brother, his three children, and then you, and maybe his, like, best friends, if he counts them.
Uh-huh. And when you say to be with him, what do you think he means? You know, again, you're speaking for him. You're imagining saying, he's saying, this is what matters. So how would you want these family members and perhaps one of his best friends to be with him? Are they in the room with him?
If he's in the hospital, most definitely, like, everybody's in the room with him, some are holding hands. If he's at home, same thing.
So
in the room.
Physically very close, possibly holding his hand. Yeah. Got it. And Isabel, what did you say as you imagined this situation? What did you imagine Dad would say?
It was hard. I agreed with one of Josh's cards, but ultimately I thought that not being a burden to his family would be the biggest one for him.
And what do you think that means if Dad were to say, how could we support him in not being a burden? How would we know that he's not being a burden to us?
I thought of it as being complete, so not leaving us, feel like regretting not having said something and not wishing that, I mean, he's our father, we're going to wish for more time. That's just a given. But to not have that, like, one thing where you just absolutely needed to say it and you didn't get a chance to. So just feeling as complete as can be.
And do you have that sense right now that Dad has said these things, that you know how Dad feels about you and about Josh and about his family? Or do you imagine maybe there are some things I want to make sure I know?
I mean, like, we say, like, oh, I love you, like, good night, like, I love you, or, like, give each other, like, a hug or something. Like, that happens on, like, a regular basis. But in the instance where if it's the last time that you're ever going to get to say this again, I don't think that he would have said that, because I feel like that last time would be different, because that's what you're going to be left with. That's, like, your last memory of that person.
I really want to acknowledge your insight in that, is that really it is what we leave people, that it's our legacy. So even after Dad and I physically aren't here, there's a lot that you actually continue to carry with us. And as you know, my own father, who really taught me how to start having these conversations, it'll be 10 years ago, right about now. I very much have him present, even though he's physically not here. But it's these conversations that he has left us as memories. So So I'm really grateful that we get to have this right now. Josh, I want to point out a card that you picked as what you thought was also really important to Dad, which is, interestingly, a card that Isabel didn't have in her top five, which was to be able to help others. Can you say what you think Dad means by that?
So my father has always been a very selfless person. He's always been thinking of other people. He always wants to, like, kind of, like, make the less commotion of everything. And so if he can kind of, before he passes away, like, help someone or something get done before it's too late. So definitely was there for me.
And the other thing I'm wanting us to think about is that this isn't just what do we want to make sure Dad does before he dies, because trust me, Dad's making sure of that for himself. This is also imagining, if Dad were so sick, what is the kind of medical care that would make sense that would keep these things that are important to him possible? And if we knew that he was going to be so incapacitated because of his sickness that he was not going to be able to, say, help someone or be aware that his family's with him, that's what we're starting to try to use these for, is to help us potentially make medical decisions on his behalf that he would make for himself if he could. So can you imagine the ways, the physical ways that Dad would or does and would say for himself want to be able to help people?
I think that he would want to start by kind of like finishing something up that he didn't start. Like if he was working with a patient that he was still helping, definitely like trying to bring that to a close before like it was just like kind of dropped at a dead end. Definitely to like, if like even though he was in bed and like couldn't talk or couldn't like signal anything, but he could like use his hands, like something along those lines of still being able to write something for that patient. Or
so being able to communicate, connect with people, yeah, is critical to how Dad is able to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And before we bring Dad in, I want, Isabel, for you to maybe address one of the cards that you also picked on behalf of Dad, which was to say goodbye to important people, people important to him in his life. And who do you imagine those people are, and in what way do you imagine he would want to be saying, be able to say goodbye to them?
So definitely his family. So like me, as well as Josh and Kalel, my youngest brother, as well as you, his wife, his parents, his brother, and probably his best friend. So that would be like his high school buddy, Captain Brendan. And just to be able to remember all like the good times. So for us to physically be there as like a physical representation of those memories, almost to like bring them back. So like as he's passing on, he's left with these good times instead of just like in a hospital bed, like remembering the good things instead.
And so I want to ask Andy, you know, first, what is it like to hear your children talk about this? And also then to specifically be able to answer for them. What are the things most important to you? And how would you want us to be able to support you while we can hear from you?
Sure. Well, I gotta say, it's kind of wild being talked about in almost the past tense. But on the other hand, it, being a physician and seeing a lot of people pass away and pass away in a lot of different ways, I certainly know how important it is to talk about these things. So, and you're right, it's uncomfortable for me to talk about this for myself. I wouldn't say it's uncomfortable for me to talk about with patients, but it is uncomfortable for me to talk about with my family. But listening to these guys talk about it and talk about what they think is important to me, it's a good feeling. And it's a good feeling because you know, you guys have captured a lot of what is important to me. So it's good to hear that I'm communicating at least somewhat well with you guys, so that you kind of know what is important to me.
Your values, how you live your life, what makes your life meaningful to you, is being communicated, not necessarily overtly, but in a way where they actually can then think about it and capture
dead
these
on
things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So one of the things I recall when you were in the hospital not that long ago, unfortunately, you're fully recovered. But this came out of nowhere. So exactly what we're talking about, a sudden, unexpected illness. You became pretty incapacitated. And I realized that even though you and I have this conversation pretty frequently and quite literally play Go Wish every year on our anniversary, I found myself wondering, how does he want me to be? What's the best way I can support you? And I realized that the next second I was going to have the chance to talk with you, I was going to ask that question. Did I do this right? Did I show up right? And physical touch, interestingly, was one of the first things for me. Does he want me to hold his hand or not? And we heard Josh say, to have people be with you, have your family and perhaps one of your best friends be with you, and even holding your hand was important, Josh imagined for you. And yet you had a really different, very vivid experience when you first awoke from your illness. You want to share that?
Sure. So so I had appendicitis this fall. And you know, as I think about sort of thinking of how I want things to go at the end of my life, this experience was really helpful in looking back at a time when I was sick and sort of thinking about how that experience went and what was important to me at the time. And as you said, one of the things that was most vivid for me is waking up from anesthesia, and there you were, like sitting there just on the side of my bed and sort of coming out of that anesthesia haze and just seeing your face right next to mine, just, you know, just smiling, seeing me wake up. And it was your presence that made the difference for me. It wasn't so much that touch. It was more the presence and more seeing you. And I think that, as I look back, is really what is a priority for me, is having people probably in my room, but not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be on my bed or holding my hand.
So really helpful to know, right? These sound like little things. And even though we're talking in the context of end of life and death and dying, the reality is what we're really talking about is what matters most to us right now while we're very much alive, what brings us comfort in those moments when we're uncomfortable. And Josh, I'm going to come back to you. When you and I first played Go Wish, it was about 4 years ago. And I have a vivid memory of you taking the deck of cards and spreading them out on the floor and just plopping yourself in the middle of them and picking each one up and going, oh my God, yes, I love this card. Oh, this is very important. Oh, this is very important. And you picked up a card, spoiler alert for those who don't want to know and want to play on your own, but you picked up a card which is called the wild card. And I have to say, I've played this card many, many times with patients, total strangers on airplanes, my family. And most people set that wild card aside immediately. They don't know what to do with it. And you were the first person who took that wild card and immediately knew what you wanted to do with it. Do you have any memory of it?
Yeah. I do.
What did you say?
I remember saying that I wanted to be at peace with God at
actually, oh, no, that was a real card. There's a card that asks if you want to be at peace with God, if that's important to you.
I don't remember it then.
So your wild card. And that's actually an important point, why we play again and again, because what matters to us changes over life. You were like 12 years old, now you're 15. So what matters changes. What you said when you were 12 for the wild card was, oh, I want people to read my favorite books to me. And you got really excited because I started to ask, how could I support you in that? What are your favorite stories? What books would you want me to read? And you said, oh, Mom, no problem. I'll take care of it. I'm going to take that first shelf of my bookshelf and make sure it's just lined with my favorite books. So anytime anyone wants to come be with me, they just grab whichever book and they'll know it's the right one. You know, and I was just so impressed with your clarity of what makes a difference for you, what you wish. And I think that's a lot of what these conversations are about. So, Isabel, one of the things I'd asked you and Josh to do as well was to consider sorting these cards for yourself. And while you've sorted them for me before, like you did for Dad, I wonder what you came up for yourself, if you'd be willing to share.
Yeah. So my top card was not dying alone. For me, that's a really big thing. I just don't want to die alone. I mean, there's no good way to put it.
So when we come back from break, I want to hear if you are able to imagine how it would look to make sure you're not alone. You're listening to Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care. In this fourth episode, we're talking about advanced care planning, and we're having a kitchen table conversation right here in the studio with my own family. I do want to let listeners know that although I and some of my guests are medical professionals, the information provided on this show is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. We're inviting you to call in toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you want to have a conversation with us, if you've had a conversation and want to share with us some of the breakthroughs, things that have surprised you, if you're wondering how to start a conversation with someone who's just not interested in talking about this stuff, give us a call. You can also email us at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. Or post on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio. Or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. So, Isabel, you were just going to share with us what it might look like to make sure you don't die alone.
So not dying alone for me doesn't necessarily mean that I'm with someone who I know. So it doesn't mean that you have to be there. So if you're across the country and I'm suddenly just like in a hospital with like minutes or something, yeah, that'd be a bummer. But as long as there's like, I don't know, like someone who else was in the accident who's like in a gurney next to me or someone, or a nurse or a doctor or just anyone. Someone
present for you. Got it. So we have a call here from Hattie in New Orleans. Hattie?
Hey, it's Hattie, like a hat.
Hattie, welcome to Dying to Talk. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, and thank you for all you're doing. And I've listened to you speaking with your husband and your children, and it's so moving. It's like to tears, because most people don't want to talk about this, and especially would not engage their children. And so congratulations to you and Andy. But, of course, you're both physicians, and that makes, I'm not saying it's easier, but because the two of you live in the world of healthcare, you engage your children in this conversation at this young age, and I think it's fantastic. But, and the downside is that most of us, I'm now 65 myself, and most of us don't want to even think about the fact that we're going to die. You know, it's like the elephant in the room. So I think that you are engaging your children. And I love the Go-Wish game. I was exposed to it not too long ago, but I've just finished a book, and it's now out, and it's called I'll Have It My Way. I'm a lay person, meaning I'm not a doctor or a nurse, although a lot of doctors and nurses helped me write this book. And it's about how we can get a peaceful death, which, as you and Andy know, it's not so easy anymore. Because you all are so good at what you do, you physicians are so good at what you do, you just keep us going. And so my book is about, for lay people, about how to, and I'm fascinated with what you're doing on this radio program, and that's why I called in.
Thank you so much, Hattie. Thank you, first of all, for being willing to share your work, your efforts, and we'll be sure to post a link to your book on the website so people can learn more. I think you point out a really important detail, which is, yes, my husband and I are both physicians. And I also want to say that we have no training teaching us how to have these conversations in medical school. So while we are exposed to this, we're still on new territory, and we're learning with you, Hattie, and everyone else out there as to how to do this. You know, my kids have been very courageous to join me. You guys have been hospice volunteers, so have been exposed to people approaching the end of life, and obviously you were both alive when my father died. I'm very present for that and have your own memories. I wonder, Andy, if you want to share specifically a detail that you think maybe Isabel and Josh don't know about the kind of care that matters to you that might be hard for them to hear, and so that they won't have a disagreement, God forbid, if they're asked to make a decision on your behalf.
Sure. So, you know, I think, again, sort of drawing from my own experiences, watching a patient of mine recently and unexpectedly have a very, very, very major heart attack. And it actually ended up leaving him unable to think clearly. And that resulted in his whole family being brought in, of course, but they hadn't talked with him about what he wanted. And so they were all left to guess. And that led to a lot of disagreement. And when I hear stories like that, there's nothing more painful, you guys. There is nothing more painful for me than the thought of my death leading to fights between you guys. And in fact, I've had a patient who went to great efforts to prolong her death, Barbara, because she was so concerned about her death further fracturing her family. So I think in terms of the key things I want you to know, you guys sort of really touched on it beautifully, that I want you guys around. I'd like my friends to be there. I'd like my life to be complete. I'd like to know my patients are going to be okay, just like you said, Josh. Those are all the big ones. And is interestingly, I don't want to die alone either. Like, that's actually one of the most painful thoughts to me, is dying alone. And sometimes we don't have control over that, as you said, but hopefully there'll be something or someone around.
We have another call here from Mary in San Francisco. She's curious about the Go-Wish cards. Mary, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thank you. How are you?
Great.
Awesome.
I took the suggestion that you had clued me into with the Go-Wish cards and immediately ordered them. And then I played Go-Wish with a subgroup of my church, which is a little Episcopal church, that's mostly Japanese American, pretty much except for me. And I was kind of nervous about it because they're a pretty taciturn group, not big talkers, and most of them are in their 80s or 90s, and we had a group of about eight, and I gave everybody a deck of cards, and everybody did it. Everybody engaged from the first moment, and when they had all sorted their cards and had their most important pile in priority, I just asked, what's your top card? And everybody shared. It was just an amazing, amazing conversation.
Mary, I'm in awe. You have me speechless. What was that like for you? And I wonder, what has it been like for you as a community since this event?
So for me, I was kind of nervous at the beginning. And as you know, this is part of the focus of my work, is to help create the movement for end-of-life conversations that are beyond the technical part of planning, which is also important, but get at the heart of what's important to people. And so I was kind of nervous because, as I said, though I'm an insider at church, I'm not related to anyone like the rest of my congregation. They're all related to one another. They all have shared experience that I don't have with them. But I know they love me. And so they were willing to engage. And I think it was a great first use of those cards for me because it was so positive.
Wow.
And so affirming for them and for me.
And I hear, you know, that it defied many barriers that you anticipated of age and of different backgrounds, different ethnicities, and different general ways of communicating. So bravo, Mary. Thank you so much for sharing that. And please continue having the conversation. I want to remind our listeners, you too can join the call. Join us by calling in at 866-798-8255. We have an email here from Maria. She says that it's great that we're having a conversation with our children. And she wonders, so I think, Isabel and Josh, this is for you, how many children actually do experience the death of a parent or a loved one and never really get to talk about it? She says often the adults at the time are not in shape, in any kind of shape, to support their children. And I wonder what your sense is of what you felt like. Certainly after my father died, I didn't feel in shape to talk with you, but what your experience was, as well as maybe talking with your own peers, your own friends. Josh?
So I remember, I guess, like, one of the more traumatic phases of death that went through was definitely when my grandpa died. We were very close. We had a routine wherever we went to visit, he would always read me this one book. And it was kind of, like, different when, like, you would go somewhere and the usual routine is completely different. And I think that having, like, talking with someone or just doing that routine with someone else kind of, like, brings that to light. And, like, even though it's not the same, it's close enough. And, like, when you get to talk about through these things with different people, it makes, like, your life way happier. And you realize that, like, sure, they're not here physically, but they're always going to be here when I do this certain thing.
You've often said, you know, that they're here, right here in the heart,
right there.
Linked to my heart. Where's Grandpa? Right here. We have another email here from someone who's doing something a little bit like Isabel is right now. Laura says she can't call because she knows she's going to start crying. It's okay. We are okay with tears. At any rate, she makes this beautiful comment I'll share, which is that she wants to say, having faced some of these kinds of moments herself, that she's decided to hold a horizontal idea of time, that all the accumulated kindnesses and intimacies over the span of a relationship hold value, and that the final moment you are with someone, whether you know it is the last time when you're having it or not, does not cast a meaning over how you came through for someone or how they came through for you, and that she tries to bring compassion to herself and to others that sometimes we stumble through these big moments. So, oh my gosh, that's just beautiful. Laura, thank you so much for finding the way to type through and join our conversation this evening, and just really wise words. Andy, you talked about some patients that have shared through their experiences under your care a wisdom or heartbreak in how to approach the end of life. One, as you mentioned, Barbara, who I had the pleasure of caring for with you, was really clear and able to express her wishes, and we were able to have her achieve some of these goals of making sure her family knew she was at peace, and others, not so much. What's your sense of how families find their way through this, and how we could maybe do a better job having conversations ahead of time when people are well, so that we don't risk that?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think thinking about how can we have these conversations, I think one of the easiest places to start is if you have something wrong with you that's, you know, a significant medical illness. And maybe it doesn't seem that bad, but I always appreciate it when patients ask me, you know, if things don't go well, what's going to happen? And have that conversation, you know, with a spouse or one of their children or a parent there, and being able to talk through that. Because as physicians, you know, we're always playing for the best and really hoping that everything's going to go well. But, you know, it's really important to talk about when things don't go well, because for sure, things don't always go well.
And I wonder, Isabel, if you're willing, it's okay. If you're not, it's hard. It's hard. What it's like to hear Dad be able to say what matters most to him, and to hear that, and do you think you'd be able to honor that if someone asked, how do we support Dad, and how do we maybe even let him go?
Oh, absolutely. When he's at that point where it's like where we are aware that his life is about to end, yeah, absolutely. I would want to honor his wishes. Like, that would be my only concern at the time. Like, I wouldn't care about myself or anything else going on. I would just want to make sure that what's going on with him and how he is feeling in, like, his last moments of life are ones that I can help to make at least as good as they possibly can. I mean, to honor his wishes seems like the only logical thing to do.
So I remember one time after having an extraordinary visit where a patient of mine who was literally on her deathbed started to knit in midair. She didn't have needles in her hand. She didn't have yarn, but she started to knit unmistakably. And her family at the bedside burst into tears, saying, yeah, in fact, this was without question her greatest joy, that which brought her the most comfort throughout her life, knitting. And I came home to you, Andy, amazed, saying, oh my gosh, I need to be sure, I need to be clear, what is your greatest joy? Should I put a kayak paddle in your hand? Should I get you on a bike? Like, what is it? And I wonder, maybe starting with you, Andy, to describe what are those sort of key features that have you know you're you, that we could do? How would we know we're supporting you in those intimate, really personal ways?
So I have no idea how you do it, but, you know, as you guys all know, I enjoy sort of disappearing into nowhere, whether it's on a bike or a kayak or going hiking in Zion National Park. And so that feeling of being out there in the middle of nowhere, that's where I'd like to be as I'm winding up my life.
And even being quite literal, one of the things that one of the cards in Go Wish is actually to have your funeral arrangements already made. Is that an important thing for you? And I believe you said that was pretty important to you to make sure that that wouldn't burden the family. And you've mentioned to me some ways to maybe have you eternally in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, you know, we have talked about that and what to do with my ashes and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's actually funny in that, as you talked about, Dawn, how our answers to these cards change. And you know, my father, it's always his number one card is, I don't want to be a burden to my family. It's always been his. I'm beginning to come around on that one. I'm not so sold on that. Like, in that I know that when we're really sick, the people around us want to be there for us, and it doesn't occur as a burden. So, that card has been downgraded for me.
Well, and it's important to really define burden. And as we've just touched upon here, and again, this is one brief conversation. It's just the opening. It's just the beginning of conversations. But we've had a couple of conversations with your parents. They've really allowed us to engage in this and literally play go-ish. And understanding what is a burden to them. What does that mean literally to them? And one of the things that was really stunning about your father was he's very clear that if he lost his eyesight, that was not something he wanted to go on experiencing life, that his quality of life would very much be dropped significantly. And what was that like for you to hear that?
Well, it's a great point that that my dad is just such a voracious reader. And it's with some irony because he enjoys listening books on tape too. But but to hear that and to know, like, yeah, that my dad, if he doesn't have his eyesight, and so he can't go out into the woods with his chainsaw and thin out the brush and whatnot, yeah, he doesn't want to be around, and I completely get that, and that certainly puts into context for me sort of some of the decisions I would be there and help him to make at the end, knowing that.
Yeah, and without us having had such an explicit conversation, I don't know that that necessarily would have just come up randomly.
No,
right?
Absolutely not.
He's never just said how important eyesight is to him. No. It's not like he is a pilot or something where eyesight, or an artist that uses their eyes in a particular way. I certainly was stunned.
Yeah, there's two other things just one other thing point to make that about that, which is I'm glad you raised that because I had forgotten that. Now, fortunately, I know that my memory is not 100% sharp, and so I also wrote that down. but it was a good reminder for me to write things down, to have the conversations not just one-on-one but with all the family, so that these things continue to live on even after we have the conversation, so we can remember back.
We can remember back and we can move forward because, as you said, things change. Josh, things have certainly changed since you were 12.
Oh, yes.
When you, I asked you to resort the cards for yourself this week, what came to the surface for you? What became important?
A lot of the things that came important were like try and help others. Like, definitely have family around me too. Definitely not be alone.
And when you think of family, to be clear, because you are 15 and you do have a younger little brother who's 8 who so wishes he were here in studio with us tonight, sometimes we can get on each other's nerves. So what do you mean when you say to have family near, and in what way?
And so I think that family is my actual family, so including him.
You heard that, Kalel.
My relatives that are like very, very close to, and then maybe like some like really good friends and people that have like they've grown into me, and like they're now like I think of them a lot and they think of me a lot, and it's just kind of like we're kind of bonded.
And I'm gonna take the liberty and add in some furry friends that are part of the family.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. really important to you, Zeus, yeah. Your cat, and our dogs.
Yeah.
Sometimes pets get forgotten, but they are very much family members for so many people. So I know that's true for me. Family, FYI, you know, asterisk, I need a cat with me. I need a cat purring with me. I really need that. You can shake your head, Andy, but it's just the way it is. Please make sure it happens, Josh.
I will make sure.
Thank you. So we have an email here, and I'm blushing. You can't see it, but I am. It's from Susan Gropes. Anyone know who that is?
Grandma.
Or mom. Gammy is so proud of you all, us all. She thinks that it's the hardest conversation. I think the hardest conversation, this is Susan speaking, is what I want my family to do in case I'm unable to make medical decisions myself, what life support I want or don't want. It was very confronting for me, herself, to have to make those decisions for her own parents. Yet it was incredibly important and a relief to have my whole family know my wishes. And Mom, you nailed it. You know, the relief for you as well as the relief for us to not have to wonder, are we doing it the way you want? Are we doing it right? What if? What should we have done? And while we can't possibly know all the possible scenarios we can't anticipate, I think understanding what gives our life meaning, like we're talking about tonight, helps us in those moments say, my gosh, if Andy can't get on a bike and he can't kayak, or if Grandpa can't read, then we need to rethink the kind of medical care we're doing. Instead of perhaps aggressive life prolonging care, consider aggressive comfort-focused care. So we have another email here from Sydney. She says that she's never thought about death until earlier in her life. She said death was something referenced in hushed tones and behind closed doors. I think a lot of you can resonate with that. And then her husband, her best friend and true love, Peyton, was diagnosed with a very aggressive and deadly esophageal cancer. And she said that it was Peyton's efforts to communicate his needs while he was able had two really profound and very positive impacts on her life. The first is that Peyton had actually deliberately told her everything she needed to know so that she was able to make a transition from beloved married couple into single home ownership and person life. The second, she says, is purely emotional, and that he was able to put so much of himself into her survival. And that she owes it to him, as well as herself, to be able to build a new life now that he's died. I think it's really important to imagine that we live on for years to come in the people whose lives we touch while we're alive, as well as the people that live on beyond us, and the legacy we leave people, the image, as Isabel, as you said, this is what we remember. I remember my father. I remember him running his fingers through your hair, Isabel, the night before he died, asking you, how was your day at camp? This is what I remember. And he was in his own bed, his wife next to him, my mother, his cat purring on his chest. These are the things we remember. This is the legacy. This is what's possible when we talk about what matters most. Isabel, do you remember the fingers?
I remember, well, we had a very non-conventional way of saying hello. I would always walk through the door, and he would whistle this very, I don't really know how to describe it, but it was this little tune, almost kind of like a train. And then I would do it right back. And so I remember doing it that last day. I remember, like, having that conversation with him. And then I remember the next time that I went to the house that he wasn't there and that there wasn't anyone whistling at me. And that was... I don't even know how to describe that feeling, but that was just emptiness.
Yeah. Yeah, and no one can replace that whistle. It's yours. It's yours alone. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Isabel. Yeah. So I'm going to take the liberty of sharing some of my most important cards to make sure you all know. One of the things my father taught me toward the end of his life was the importance of asking people what they want, what they wish. There's a difference between knowing what we need and knowing what we want. And while I know I want all of you with me for much longer than I imagine any of us are going to have, that's just the way life is. I also know what I need. And what I need is for each of you to know how blessed and loved I feel around you, how grateful I am that you're here with me tonight, that you know how to hold my hand, Josh, when I can't even ask for it, how to rub my back, how to put a cat in my arms, how you, Isabel, know how to find the music I need to listen to exactly when I need to listen to it, and how you, Andy, know how to hold me like nobody else can. These are the things that matter to me now, when I'm well, now when I'm less well, and they will absolutely matter to me when I'm at the end of my life. Any final things you want to share in this one conversation, Andy? I see you staring at me.
No, I'm just thinking about how nice it is to hold you.
It's mutual, honey.
It's a great feeling knowing when someone knows that what you want. It's great knowing that they can on hand bring you something that no will make you 10 times better than you were 2 seconds ago.
Yeah. With that, I want to thank my beloved guests this hour. We've had my teenage children, wiser than their years, to be sure, Josh and Isabel Gross, and my beloved husband, Andrew Gross. Thank you all so much for being here tonight, for being willing to discuss what matters most for yourselves and for each other. I pinch myself every day, and I'm grateful that I get to be your mother and your wife. And I want to thank everyone who's called in or emailed us during tonight's program. It's your curiosity and courage to join this conversation that makes it possible for each of us to discover what matters most in our lives. April 16th, just around the corner, is National Healthcare Decisions Day. So give yourself and those you love the gift of a lifetime and start a conversation. Death is for the living, and how we die is a legacy we leave to those who care for us long after we're gone from sight. Dying to Talk is produced at the studios in KALW in San Francisco. Rosalie Atkinson is in the in-studio producer, and Joanne Marr is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum created the promos. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kilbanes. Tools that we've used, like Go Wish Tonight, are on our webpage at kalw.org, and this entire conversation will also be available for online listening in the next hour. And you can listen to all the programs in this special series, including how we talk about how talking about death can change your life, or how to avoid getting caught in the machinery of medicine can actually be good for your health, as well as keys to navigating the maze of caregiving. You'll also find resources related to each of those programs at kalw.org. And if you're dying for more Dying to Talk, be sure to post your comments on our webpage at kalw.org. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me,
life is uncertain.
Better eat dessert first.
Who's ready for apple pie and ice cream?
In the world tonight, don't know where you're going.